nanohub.org.
You can follow along with this presentation using printed slides from the NanoHub. Visit www.nanohub.org and download the PDF file containing the slides for this presentation. Enjoy the show.
So, just to remind you where you were, in order to calculate current versus voltage, you need this density of states. How do you get density of states? Well, experimentally, you try to measure it with different kinds of experiments. Theoretically, when you try to model it, you start from Schrodinger equation. And we went through, it's a fairly long process. At the end of it, from Schrodinger equation, you can get this EK relationships that we talked about. And we talked specifically about graphene, a particular material, where the EK relationship looks something like this. Around one of the valleys can be written as this. That's one example. Another one that's very common, that's in most semiconductors people write it as, is epsilon k equals some constant plus h bar square over 2m times kx square plus ky square. I guess in three dimensions you'd have a plus kz square as well. But if you had a two-dimensional conductor, it looks something like this. And that's what you usually refer to as the effective mass. And note that in general, this E versus K is a fairly complicated function for all kinds of, for all values of K. But you often look around some special points and try to get simple expressions that you can easily work with. Now, once you have this epsilon of K, then you can deduce a this quantity we talked about called density of states, which in principle is just a series of delta functions. Just a series of spikes. But then, when you have a big conductor, you can turn that summation into an integral with the idea that, well, if you have something like this in kx and ky, then the allowed values are separated by 2 pi over L in the x direction, and they're separated by, say, 2 pi over W. If W is the dimension in the y direction, and L is the dimension in the x direction. And when L and W are large, these things are sufficiently close together that you could turn it into an integral. And when you turn that into an integral, you can actually get a smooth-looking curve out of it, you see? And experimentally also, that's the fact that when you look at big conductors, there's a way of measuring density of states. And when you measure it, usually you'd see smooth curves with big conductors. And when you go to small things, one of the, I guess, evidence that you're looking at really small things is that you start seeing spikes in your density of states that you measure. Really. Now, what we did last day was I introduced another concept, which is this density of modes, which is sort of like density of states, except that there is this idea of a velocity included. That is, states, density of states means just how many states you have in a given energy range. But as I tried to explain last day, in general, with all these energy states, you can classify them into two groups. One that carries current in one direction, the other that carries current in the opposite direction. Right? And that is based on the concept of a group velocity that's determined by del E del K in the direction you're interested in. And this quantity, this number of modes, it's a very good measure of if you're trying to calculate the current in a particular direction. So as I said last day, this is a concept that you don't see much in the literature, say 20 years ago. But it's something you see a lot more these days because people are looking at all kinds of ballistic conductors where the current flow is in a some direction, say, I'll call that X. And the question is, what is the conductance of this if this length is really small? So if you have a ballistic conductor, like as I said, every laptop has about a billion transistors in it, and each of these transistors is about, you know, hundreds of atoms long. And those are almost at the ballistic limit. So you could ask the question, if you take a transistor whose typical width these days would be 10th of a micrometer, 100 nanometers, and you measure the conductance, put a small voltage, see what current flows, what will you get? And the thing is, you expect intuitively it should be proportional to the width. The point is that in small conductors, it is actually equal to this quantum of conductance that we talked about earlier in the course, times the number of modes around the chemical potential. And that's why this quantity has become so important. That's why people look at this in small ballistic conductors, because the conductance is this 2q squared over h. That's the quantum of conductance. By the way, the 2 has to do with spin. And I sometimes forget to write it, but that's implied. This is the quantum of conductance, the 2 spins. Okay. And then you multiply it by m around your chemical potential. Because m is a function of energy. So the question is, at what energy do you look? And the answer is, you should look at, like, if your chemical potential is around here, and here we are talking of small bias, so you say there's not much difference between this and this, just a small voltage, then the conductance will depend on the number of modes at that energy. So this is the new concept that we could discuss last day. And in principle, again, the way you evaluate it is very similar to that. And also, in terms of this number of modes, what I showed was that you could write the current in this way. Just as, in terms of the density of states, you can write the number of electrons. You know, this one has a simple explanation usually, that you have got a certain density of states. F is the function that tells you whether a state is occupied or not. And if you're in equilibrium, this F would be the Fermi function. If you're not in equilibrium, it can be something else, and you'd have to figure out what it is. But then density of states times the Fermi function tells you how many electrons you have in there. That's how many states you have. This is what fraction of it is filled. And then you integrate, you get the total number of electrons. That's intuitive. Now for current, this number of modes plays a similar role. That this is a number of modes. If a particular mode is filled, it sort of carries current. F1 tells you what fraction of it is filled. What fraction of the positive going ones are filled. And F2 tells you what fraction of the negative going ones are filled. And this is where, this is something that only true for ballistic conductors. The important point that I tried to get across last day is that in ballistic conductors, you could argue that of all the states that are available, there's half going this way and half going that way. And in a ballistic conductor, the group going this way is filled from this reservoir, whereas the group going the other way is filled from that reservoir. And so this is occupied according to F1, that's occupied according to F2. And so the amount of current going from left to right is given by this first term, M of E, F1. And the amount of current going from right to left is given by the second term, F2. And so this is an expression that you can use for ballistic conductors. Okay. And one point I wanted to make, which is why I wrote down these equations today. This, I don't know if you remember this, but at the beginning of the course, I think for quite a few lectures, I was writing these every day, back in September. You know, we said that, well, given a density of states, how do you calculate the current? Well, that's the expression. And what you need to know is this gamma 1 and gamma 2. Gamma 1 that tells you how easily electrons get in and out from this contact. Gamma 2 tells you how easily they get in and out of that contact. And if gamma 1 is equal to gamma 2, then you see, I could have written this as gamma 1 divided by 2, let's say. You know, if those two things were equal, then I could just write it as a single gamma divided by 2. Now, for ballistic transport, we now have this expression. Now, the question is, what's the connection between this and that? Okay? And that's the point I just wanted to make, because, as I said, back in September, this is what you were using. Now, after talking about EK relations and all that, we got to this. This is something I couldn't have quite written down before, because we didn't have this concept of two types of states, one going left and one going right, for which you need an EK relation. And of course, to get to an EK relation, we needed to go through everything we went through in October, essentially. So back in September, I really couldn't have quite talked about these things. Okay. Now, the question is, what's the connection between the two? Now, if you just look at it algebraically, now, what do I need to make those two things give me the same answer? Then you can see that, roughly speaking, M should be equal to D, so rather M over H should be equal to D times gamma over 2. I'm kind of running out of space here a little bit. Over H bar. Something like that. This is just to make those two things the same. And what's the relation between H and H bar? You remember, H is, of course, 2 pi H bar. So the H bar cancels. So there's a 2 pi. So what that means is M is kind of like, actually, let me get this out of the way. I'll write this back again later. So M is kind of like pi d gamma. So we're just asking that if this is true, then those two equations are the same. That's all I'm saying. Okay. On the other hand, looking from here, you can kind of see what M is. It's really d times pi h bar vx over L. Right, so M is really something like pi d h bar vx over L, the way we're doing it. So you'd think that those two equations would be consistent, would be much the same, if, of course, you think of gamma as h bar vx over L. So this is just a simple algebraic argument. Now let me explain physically why that's so. Yeah.
I don't know what the physical prerequisites for this. If we suppose, let's suppose that the special relation is not even, it has a different behavior for negative values of kx and different for positive values. Could we interpret the currents, the two constituent currents in our current relation as plus x and minus x currents?
Normally, without a magnetic field, always, for every state going this way, there would be another going the other way. So they would always be evenly matched. Now, with a magnetic field, though, things are a little different and require separate discussion. Right? But without a magnetic field, they would always be usually paired up. Okay. Now, so algebraically, I'm saying those two equations would be much the same if this was true, if we associate gamma with h bar vx over L. Now, physically, why would you want to do that? Well, that's something I think I had mentioned back in September once. The argument went like this, that when you have a really small conductor, then the rate at which electrons empty into the contact just depends on how well connected you are to the contact. Because it doesn't take you long at all to get from one side of your channel to the other. The main time involved is getting out and getting in. So that's what happens in really small conductors. Okay. But once you're talking of conductors that are 100 angstroms or tens of nanometers long, then, and you have good contacts so that getting in and out is not an issue, then the real time, that the time it really takes is the time it takes you to get from one end of your channel to the other. That's the important time then. And remember, what gamma was supposed to be in this equation was what we call the escape time. The idea that if I put an electron in here, how long does it take to get into the contact? And the point I'm trying to make is that if you had a reasonably long channel with good contacts, then the important time is not so much how fast you get out here, but just how fast you can get from one side to the other. And that is what this is. You see, L over Vx is basically the time it takes for you to get through the channel. And then h bar divided by time, that would then be the appropriate gamma to use. So this would be my argument for how you could use what we did back in September for ballistic transport. You'd say we got good contacts, so the gamma is not something associated with contacts anymore. It's really associated with how fast you get through the channel. And in that limit of things, you see, we have another way of thinking about ballistic transport, namely that you have two groups of states, plus k and minus k, and electrons just come in from here, go on out through one group of states, electrons come in from here, and go on out from the other group of states. And for every group of states, so there's a corresponding one there. This, as someone raised, that is generally true as long as there's no magnetic fields, at least. This one's okay. Now, again, if you looked at the, back in September, we had written an expression for the number of electrons, you know, which I had wiped out from here. And there, if you remember, the expression we had was, it is integral dE, density of states, times something that you could call the occupation of the states. And this was given by a weighted average of F1 and F2. The idea was that you had a bunch of states here. One contact was trying to fill it up according to F1. The other is trying to fill it up according to F2. And so the actual occupation is this weighted average. Now, if gamma 1 is equal to gamma 2, then you realize that I can cancel it out. You know, gamma 1 and gamma 2 are equal, so I can just cancel this and put a 2 here. So then the occupation is like F1 plus F2 over 2. So you could interpret this as saying that your density of states, half your states are occupied according to F1 and the other half are occupied according to F2. You could have said that, which is kind of what we are now saying, and also giving a meaning to which half is occupied according to F1 and which half is occupied according to F2. You're saying that your entire states can be classified into these northbound lane and a southbound lane. And one is occupied from here, one's occupied from there. Okay. So that's this new aspect that, you know, after talking about EK relations and all that, we come to. And usually in most of the literature, people think in terms of EK relations and do all, this is the way they do it. But in this class, as I mentioned earlier, that we were trying to, the point I was trying to make is that, well, if you're trying to understand small devices, then you can really understand how current flows and what is involved without necessarily understanding EK relations. But the thing is, the way the literature usually is, till you know EK relations and understand it, and which, as you realize, process, this is not a trivial concept. It takes a while to digest what EK relations are, where it comes from, and all that. And most of the literature would kind of start with EK relations. You say that, well, till you understand EK relations, we can't have a conversation. Whereas the point I'm trying to make is, not really. The important thing is the density of states, really. And one question that these days often people raise is, well, EK relationships, that only holds if you had an infinite periodic solid, the way this whole argument goes, you know, if you had something that's very large. Now, we are talking about devices that are hundreds of atoms. Does that really qualify for an EK relation? Is it big enough for an EK relation? And my answer to that would be possibly not very well, but then as long as the density of states you deduce from it is reasonably close, that's what really matters. So what really matters, the reason EK relations are still widely used and work reasonably well is because at the end of the day, they give you density of states that are about right. And if they're not, you adjust to fit the experiment so you can go on from there, really. The important thing at the end of the day is really density of states. And I'd say in this context, this density of modes. Okay. Now, the other thing I want to go through today a little bit is, I'll write this density of modes, we'll work with this, and write it in a slightly different way that gives you a different view of what this means. Because one way to think about this is, it's just like density of states, but multiplied by the velocity. So states that don't move too much is kind of sort of de-emphasized because it gets multiplied by the velocity. And that makes sense because current, it's not enough to have a state. It needs to move along also. Okay. Now, there is another way of looking at this, which is what I want to kind of talk about today. And in the process, what we'll also try to do is get an answer for the question that if you had a transistor, a ballistic transistor, so that electrons go from the one contact to the other without scattering, and it's about a tenth of a micron wide, what would be the conductance? What is this ballistic conductance? Okay. Okay, so in this context then, by the way, it's like this equation that we had back in September. If I put a 2 pi here so that this becomes h, then I should also put a 2 pi here. And then whatever's out here, you could call the number of modes. And then you could use this same equation for ballistic conductors, essentially. You know, the argument that we went through, that these gammas you could replace with h bar v over l, and then this just becomes like number of modes. And then that's really the same equation that I just erased. Okay. Now, one concept that we talked about in this context was this idea of subbands. Now, how does that work? Well, let's take, say, this one. It's a simpler one. So let me write this up here. Now, when I'm thinking of a two-dimensional conductor, this epsilon is a function of kx and ky. So I've got this kx, ky plane. Every place there's an energy. So conceptually, it's sort of like for a given energy, and since it's like a circle, as you can see, it's almost like the equation for a circle. And for this discussion, we can even drop this. We just call that zero. Now, you can see that all points on a circle like this would have the same energy. Because kx squared plus ky squared is much the same. Okay. So the way you usually try to visualize this is what is the energy at different points in kx and ky. Now, when you have a conductor that is carrying current in the x direction, and let's say the y direction is relatively small with a certain width w, then you could say that in the y direction, these levels are relatively far apart along ky. Why? Because the spacing is 2 pi over w, and w is a small number, let's say. On the other hand, in the x direction, we are saying it's a long wire. So we got lots of, it's long, so you got lots of states here that are very close. So you could think of kx as almost being continuous. This is the direction you could convert into an integral if you like. But this is the direction that you want to keep discrete. So then often people draw what are called subbands. Subbands meaning they say, well, let's take one value of ky. Let's say this one, fixed ky. And at that ky, let's draw what E looks like as a function of kx. So the idea is that ky has certain specific values. I'll put an N there. You usually try not to use two subscripts, but I think you get it, that ky can take on certain specific values given by an integer n, and that's equal to n times pi over w. So if it's a box of width w, then you could say ky times w has to be a multiple of pi. And if it happened to be a periodic boundary condition, you know, like a nanotube something, then how would you change this? You'd put a 2 pi over w there. Right? This we have gone through a few times. Okay. So the idea is that for every integer n here, 1, 2, 3, you got different values of ky. And for every integer n then, I could draw an epsilon as a function of kx. which would look something like and so I have this epsilon as a function of kx, but for different values of n. So if I plot this, it would look something like this. It's like a constant and then this parabola. So it's sort of like something here, something here, something here. Right, right. This is a little misleading because I kind of drew them equally spaced, whereas what he's pointing out is that the spacing would keep increasing somewhat as you go through. If this is the condition, then you'd expect it to increase. That's true. Okay. So these then are called the subbands. Okay. Now, if I stand at a particular energy, E, and I asked a question, how many modes there are at this energy? Okay. Now, what I've told you so far, you'd say, well, I'll have to go back and evaluate this. We'd have to take the density of states, multiply all this stuff. We'd have to do all this. But there's actually a very simple answer to this one. And that is, the number of modes, the way I've drawn it, should just be 3. In other words, the number of modes is actually equal to the number of subbands that are available at that energy. Okay. Now, this sounds like a totally different thing from what I told you before. You see? And what I want to show you mathematically is that those are actually the same thing. Okay? And it's important to recognize both. Yeah.
This one also depends on the number of which values of n takes. N, but what are these values? N takes 1, 2, 3
in this case, right?
Why until 3? Oh, sure.
4, 5, all that, but very good. Right. So what he's asking is, what about 4? Well, the 4 is somewhere up here. And so if I'm standing at this energy, the point is that never crosses this one. So I'm supposed to look at how many there are below it. That's the point. How many there are below? Yeah.
This function, is it increasing with increasing energy or in the conduction band?
M?
Yes.
Usually it would be increasing, as you can see. If you had a picture like this, then if you were here, it would be 2. If it were here, it would be 1. If it were here, it would be 0. Right?
And also for a specified epsilon, it depends on the W. If you increase or decrease W, all of them goes up and down.
Right. So if you're standing at this energy and you say change the width of this thing, then you could get them closer together and so you'd have more modes.
Due to that W.
Exactly. Now, in fact, you see, one of the classic experiments that really I'd say in a way had a very important influence on our entire thinking, that was back in 1988. Actually, two groups reported that experiment about the same time. And what they did was the following. They had a piece of semiconductor where they could measure the current flow through a constriction like this. So it's like these regions are all depleted. So current, so you have a contact here and a contact here, and this width you can control. So you can make this narrower or wider by applying a voltage on this, by which you deplete what's underlying. And this experiment was done on, I believe, in gallium arsenide, 1988. And what this showed was the following. When you look at the conductance meaning you apply a small voltage, measure how much what current you get through it, current divided by voltage. When you do that, and so this axis is like the gate voltage that you're applying here, and what it does is it changes the width. So in a way, this axis, of course, experimentally, it's the gate voltage on here, but physically, it's like the width of that thing, whatever that is. Now, what would you think it would be? Now, from Ohm's law, what you think it should do is, it should do something like this, linear. Ohm's law says that the wider you make something, more current you get through it, linear. What they actually saw was, it went up in steps like this. Why? The understanding is that as you change this width, it's like out here at the Fermi energy, at the chemical potential, you had zero modes. Why? Because it was so narrow that everything had been pushed up. Then you made it a little wider, and one of them slipped in under your, this is the Fermi energy or your chemical potential. So the way I've drawn it, once you have three of them, that's when you get a conductance that's like three times the quantum of conductance. And of course, this height was 2q square over h. That corresponds to a resistance of about 12.9 kiloohms. Before this, there was enormous debates, all through the 80s, about what is the resistance of a ballistic conductor. Very big minds arguing about exactly what it should be, how should you define it, does it make sense, does it even make sense to talk about the resistance of something small, all that. It's not at all clear. And these two experiments in 1988 more or less changed all that, more or less settled the issue. And which, again, is a very good example of why experiments are really so important. See? But, yeah, here the way you understand it is, again, in terms of, conductance is, like I'd said before, 2q square over h times the number of modes. But what you don't quite see from the formula I have here is that the number of modes is really the same as how many of these subbands I have. Because those two seem like two totally different things. And what I want to show you for the next 5 or 10 minutes is that expression can be recast in a form that will tell you that it's equal to the number of subbands, really. Those two are the same thing, really. That's what I want to do. Yeah.
This special relationship that you have written there, it's about the quantum well. Isn't it?
Which one? This one that I wrote? This, I'd say, is most semiconductors, for the conduction band, you could usually write it like this around the valley, because these EK relationships usually look something like this in gallium arsenide. That's the conduction band, that's the valence band. And what we are writing here is this little part here. So we are writing a function like this, which is correct only around here. Everywhere else, it's wrong. But this is still good enough for us as long as all electrons of interest are right there. That's the argument.
So why would you not have a plus kz square?
I should have. In general, I should have a plus kz square. I left it out because these experiments were all done in what's called these two-dimensional electron systems. That is, this gallium arsenide was like a thin film that was grown on top of an insulating substrate. Actually on aluminum gallium arsenide, so that all electrons are confined in one layer. So you could say as if, as far as the z direction is concerned, there's only one subband to worry about, whatever that is. And for this discussion, that's kind of part of this. So you can just worry with kx and ky.
The reason that I'm asking that after that, if we suppose that the special relationship has not kx, ky, just kx, then in this case, you don't have subbands.
You don't have
subbands.
No, you have new subbands now because of the KY.
No, if we suppose that the special relationship is this one, but without KX or KY.
Right. So, okay, let me just... So the point you're making is that I could have started from here. Right? Now, if I start from there, then I'd say that just as I said ky is an integer times pi over w, similarly kz is some other integer, not n, say n prime, times pi over the thickness in the z direction. I'll call that a t. And for these two-dimensional layers, this is a very small number. So we are saying like 10 nanometers or less, talking few nanometers thickness. You know, that's like every transistor, it relies on a surface layer whose thickness is extremely small. So as far as this direction is concerned, only thing that matters is the n prime equal to 1. If you put n prime equals 2, the energy is too high. It's way up someplace. You don't need to worry about it. So since only one value is involved, what I said was, whatever this gives, we could just lump it into this constant in front. Don't need to write it. And say we said, okay, let's go on from here. Okay? That's all, what it is. Okay, so what I wanted to show next is that how you could rewrite this M in a slightly different form. Okay. Now, the first thing I want to show is, let me write this up here. So your M of E, the expression I have, I could write it like this. So I am supposed to sum over all allowed values of k vector, that is kx and ky. So I'm writing that as a double sum. I have to sum over kx and I have to sum over ky. Right? And so for the moment, let's just think of a one-dimensional wire, you know, where you don't even have to worry about all these subbands. Let's say we just had something like this. You know, you have some epsilon versus kx. We're just doing that. We don't even have to do any summations. Question is, what would this number of modes be if we just had any function like this? So supposing for this 1D, we are doing the following sum. So I'm trying to do this sum. By the way, I've often mentioned that for delta functions, you can write x minus a or a minus x. Doesn't matter either way. Okay. Do that. Now, if I want to evaluate this, what's the next step? Turn summation into an integral. Right, as far as x direction is concerned, it's a long thing. Just turn it into an integral. So you got integral dkx, and then? So divided by 2 pi over L, which amounts to multiplied by L over 2 pi. So the summation over kx becomes that. Standard. Then there's this delta epsilon minus E. And then I have that pi over L. Now, when I do this integral, this kx goes from minus infinity to plus infinity. Remember that? Okay. Now, this pi over L and h bar v, as you remember, is partial of epsilon with respect to kx, dE dk. Now, this integral of over k runs from minus infinity to plus infinity. But I could, you know, put a 2 there and just integrate from 0 to infinity, remember? Because that was the idea that, you know, you have sum with positive velocities, sum with negative velocities. You only want to sum the positive ones. But then if you sum over everything, there's this extra 2 there. Okay. Now, the point I want to make is, you'll notice how simple actually this integral is. Simple because, yes, please, yes. The factor of 2? Okay. Yeah, what is happening is the summation over kx, what I had here was an integral from minus infinity to plus infinity. Summation over kx, which means on kx you are supposed to run all the way from here to there. Now, on this side, that velocity, which is the derivative of e with respect to k, that's negative. So, you know, all these sides, this side, the velocity is in the negative x direction. Here, the velocity is in the positive x direction. So, of course, if you just sum all that, you'll get 0. No question. Which is why, of course, here we put this mod sign here. So that when you add it up, what you get is twice what you get from this side. So what we are now putting is this 2 and then just the positive side. Okay. Right, but now we don't need in the sense that we are only integrating over the positive side, for which it's positive anyway. So you could put this, but since I'm only integrating on this side, where that quantity is positive, I really don't need it. So it's sort of like I really needed it, when I had a minus infinity to plus infinity, because then for the upper equation, I should have kept it. Absolutely, agreed. So I should have kept it here. This should have been there as long as I was going minus infinity to plus infinity. But once I go only positive, I can drop the mod sign. I don't really need it anymore. Got it. Yeah, absolutely. Very, very good. Okay. Now you'll notice something. That this integral is actually very simple to do. Why is that? Well, because you see, you have a dk and d epsilon dk, so that really amounts to d epsilon. And the 2s and pi's all cancel. So what you get is something very simple. Integral 0 to infinity, d epsilon, delta epsilon minus e. Right? And right? That's it. Now, what is that? Now, actually, that's a trick question, though, you see. Trick question in the sense that your tendency is to say 1. But it could be 0 also. Why is this? Because it would be 1 if the integral were actually running minus infinity to infinity. But the thing is that it's only 1 as long as, you know, it's like you have a delta function someplace and you're integrating it. Oh, this is epsilon, and the delta function is at e. And thing is, you're integrating. Now, if you integrate out here, of course, you get 0. You get non-zero answers as long as the region you're integrating includes the e. That's the point. So, strictly speaking, you see, that answer should be theta e minus epsilon. Now, what do I mean by theta? That's what's called this unit step function, right? So the way you define theta, usually, so when I write theta e minus epsilon, what it looks like is something so that as long as e is bigger than epsilon, you get this, and if it's less, you get 0. That's the thing. Anyway, so the bottom line here is that the number of modes in a band like this is actually 1 as long as the energy is above this, which of course makes sense. If your energy was here, there is no modes. So that's basically what this theta is all about. So mathematically, what you're really saying is that if I took this and tried to draw the corresponding number of modes as a function of energy, what it would look like is something like this. So it would be 1 above the bottom of the band, but it would be 0 below it. That's about all we are saying. So this is this very nice result in 1D, that as long as I have a 1D band, this is really what it looks like. Now, by contrast, if you had looked at the density of states for a 1D band, what would it look like? Density of, this I mentioned before, in 1D, the density of states is just the inverse of this slope. So when you're 0, it's like very high. So it's actually like 1 over V. You know, V is like the slope, dE/dK. Velocity is dE/dK. It's like 1 over that. So it's something like this. It goes as 1 over V. So how come this becomes constant? Well, that's because, you see, number of modes is actually density of states times the velocity. So here, so in 1D, the density of states is the inverse of velocity. And so the number of modes is constant. So the faster an electron moves, the less the density of states, because it doesn't quite spend too much time anywhere. It's going too fast. But the point is, number of modes, that's current it's carrying is kind of fixed. Anyway, those you can think about. But remember, the point I was trying to get at, though, is that in general, when you have many, many subbands, then what happens is this epsilon k looks like epsilon n kx. Right? Because this n is all the different allowed values of ky. So you have the summation here, and what we have talked about is kind of this part. So when you have lots of subbands like this, what will the number of modes look like? Well, basically it's like whatever discussion we had for this one gave us this. If we had had the same discussion about this next one, you'd have got something like this. So if I add those two, it will look like that. And then if we had the same discussion about this one, you'd have got something like this, because always it goes from 0 to 1 right at the bottom of the band. And when you add it, it will look like that, and so on. So basically the number of modes with a bunch of subbands will look like a step function, you know, something that goes 0, 1, 2, 3, etc. And since the conductance is proportional to that, it also works much the same way. That if you could actually move the Fermi energy along this, the conductance would also go 0, 1, 2, 3, etc. That's kind of the argument here. So this is a very different view of M that kind of follows from here. But you could, mathematically what you can do is you could write this as, this is a sum over all k. Instead, you could just sum over the ky, meaning, you know, if you're traveling along the x direction, then you're summing over all k's perpendicular to the x direction, ky, kz, whatever, and then have a theta e minus epsilon ky part. So k epsilon with kx equals 0. But physically, the reason it's useful is you can think of this number of modes as just how many subbands you have. But the tricky part is this, that if you had a subband, for example, whose EK relation was going like this, let's say, somewhere in the valence band is going like this. The question is, at this energy, would I count that subband? Absolutely not. Because this one is going downwards. I only count those that actually, you know, turn up and cross this energy. Otherwise, I wouldn't even know about that one. Because for a subband like that, the number of modes would have looked something like something that's going downwards. Really, on something like this. So this is the tricky part that, you see, if you just say, well, you take an energy and count how many you have below, that doesn't quite do justice to the whole thing. Because you only count those that actually turn upwards and cross, etc. So mathematically, of course, this is still correct. But when turning it into something like this, you have to be careful. This wouldn't be all that clear. But anyway, but physically, I'd say, you know, the importance of M has always been that it really settled a very important conceptual question in this whole field. namely, what is the conductance of a ballistic conductor, which, as I said, back in the 80s was not at all clear. And once this got clear, that's when the field sort of took off, because till this was clarified, it was like very confused, not quite clear where to go. But once this was clear, everything else kind of fell in place. So let me stop here and